Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Welcome back, Tiger fans, to Rock Him Nation's football podcast. I'm Nate Edwards. That's Josh Matica. This is Before the Box Score, the Dad Pod Edition version 2. Air horns, Josh. Welcome back, my man.
Thanks, man. It's good to be back. I listened to the podcast, as I do every single week. It was weird to hear my own voice, and I was really happy that I seem to have, at least in some meaningful way, foregone the early days when listeners would call me a Valley girl because of the amount of times I said like. I'm very proud of myself for that. I do feel as if I still bring a good NPR energy, as Madam Editor Karen Steger would say. But yeah, it's good to be back. I appreciate y'all having me on for a week's worth of podcasts.
I know. That jerk BK is still hanging out on the East Coast. Like, there's nothing happening. So, you know, we get to bring in, yeah, NPR Josh. I like that. NPR Josh. What would, I don't know, what would be your NPR topic if you were actually an NPR radio guy?
Oh, man. I mean, I love movies, but I feel as if movies, I think that's a saturated market. Mm-hmm. I think that at this point, I would be really, really interested in doing a podcast specifically about children's entertainment, maybe. Just specifically about children's music and movies, mm-hmm. and the things that I think are good and bad. This is a pro Bluey and Tumbleleaf household.
Hell yeah.
So, yeah, brother. Low sensory experiences for these guys.
Look, we're going to get to Missouri football here in a second. Y'all need to sit down. Take a knee, huddle up. When you reproduce, children's entertainment is bad. So when you find something that is good, you need to do everything in your power to get your kids on board. And no joke, the wife and I will watch Bluey unironically without kids around. It is a good show. When my best friend Adam got married this summer, we had some downtime between our activities during the bachelor party. I turned on the TV. I got everybody addicted to Bluey. It's just a solid show about Australian blue heelers. Like, maybe the best one on TV. So pro Bluey over here, my man. Pro Bluey.
I feel like the Bluey hive is actually pretty big at this point. A lot of podcasts that I listen to feature dads, and every single one of them, I think without fail at this point, is a pro Bluey podcast. So let it be known that Rock'em Nation's Before the Box Score is a pro Bluey podcast. You can put that in the show notes.
Absolutely.
I guess no free ads except for when it's Bluey.
right. And I think you should leave. Those are the only ads that we openly endorse.
The two most similar shows in the world, truly.
Truly. Oh, all right. Enough dad talk. We got Missouri football to talk about. And of course, we're going to kick it off with whatever the hell happened last Saturday. As always, we talk about the game that happened immediately after it happened. And then we wait a couple days and we think about it. And I put out a Beyond the Box score and we think about it some more. Josh, do you feel any differently about Missouri's performance against Vanderbilt? Or does it still just suck?
Hold on. So you're telling me that the point of this podcast is that we were actually supposed to keep thinking about that game and then we just talk about it again?
Look, man.
This is a raw deal. I didn't sign up for this.
Look, surprise. The best surprises are live surprises. So go ahead. There you go.
You know, I thought about it a little bit more earlier today. And I mean, at the risk of bad radio, I just don't have a whole lot more to say. I think when I revisited both the offense and the defensive performances in my head, the thing that I kept coming back to was that I think the bye week, as opposed to giving the team more life and kind of rejuvenating them for the second half, I wonder if it just made them come out flat, which, you know, fair enough. I suppose that happens to certain people, but I also wonder what that says about the coaching staff and about the if all the players could talk about in the bye week is how close they were feeling and how close they felt that they were to a breakthrough. And that's the performance that you come out with the Saturday after the bye week, again, during homecoming with biggest crowd, home crowd since 2019. There's not a lot of positive stuff you could say about that. I can't remember if we talked about this on Sunday, but I do feel as if the more that I think about this team, the more that I think they're one of those teams that plays to their level of competition. Sure. And I think that's a pretty simple assessment, right? You look at the way they played against Georgia and they almost beat the best team in the country. Really, aside from the Kansas State trip, they have been in pretty much every single game for a good majority of the game. And, you know, certain times it looks like they're going to win. Certain times they kind of are always scratching to get that lead. But I just, when it comes to that type of team that plays to the level of their competition, it feels, you feel okay because you think, well, you know, we're going to maybe probably be in every game. But you never feel good about rooting for a team like that because the other shoe is always looking to drop. And sooner or later, it's going to drop for Missouri. Now, to be fair, they could pick up a shoe along the way if they, you know, beat South Carolina on the road or take down Kentucky or something like that. But you're always liable to lose to a team like Abilene Christian or, I don't know, hopefully not New Mexico State. You don't love to root for a team like that. You would much rather teams go after it and get after it. And just the more I think about it, the more I think, yeah, Missouri plays to its level of competition.
No, I would agree with that. I think the biggest takeaway for me is Missouri is a second quarter team, not second half, second quarter. Mm. If you take a look at their success rates by quarter, which I always break out, and Beyond the Box score. If you take a look at that for every game other than K-State and Abilene Christian, just throw those out. Those were anomalies. Okay. Here are Missouri's success rates in the second quarter of each of those games. Louisiana Tech, 50%. Auburn, 60%. Georgia, 44%, which was the highest of that game. So heads up. Florida, 62%. Vanderbilt, 62%. Eli Drinkwitz cannot script an opening script. He can counterpunch exactly once. That's in the second quarter. And then everything else falls off in the third and fourth quarters where everything regresses down to 27%, 30%, 28%. This team, and I've seen a couple articles address it from Dave Matter and Gabe DiArmond. They talk about the middle eight. Middle eight is the last 4 minutes of the first half and the first 4 minutes of the second half. And coaches are now making it a big deal. Oh, you got to win the middle eight. Got to win the middle eight to make an impact on the game. Well, I don't know if Eli Drinkwitz is doing that, but he's certainly winning the second quarter because that's when his team, his offense, performs at its best. So, okay, buckle in. He's got one quarter of good offense, and it's going to be the second quarter. Whether that is part of the playing down part or not, I'm not totally sure, but that's kind of the biggest thing I took away from that. Outside of that, I would agree with you. It's just, you know, the way that they play is very, very slow, all based on the run game, not a lot of risks, unless you just want to call any time he passes being a risk, which that's fine. And then just hope your defense can hold and hope that your special teams unit doesn't have a surprise explosion somewhere down the line. And if you play it that way, you are going to shorten the game. You are going to keep it close, whether the opponent is better than you or inferior to you. So that's just kind of how it's going to be. Missouri is going to get blown up a lot when it runs the ball. There's going to be like a 20% at least havoc rate from opposing defenses. Their defense is going to make things go boom too, probably at a 30 to 40% clip. Missouri is going to look like dog crap basically for three full quarters. And then the fourth quarter, they're going to find themselves somehow one score down, and either it's going to go their way or it's not. And Josh, that's just how it's going to be this year. Are you okay with that?
I mean, it's better than not being good in any quarters, I guess. Although a 25% success rate in terms of quarters played well is, not good. Yeah. I wonder if I like the way that you framed it in terms of Eli Drinkwitz not being able to write an opening script, being able to counterpunch once, and then basically just being lost for the third and fourth quarters. But I wonder if there's something to that too, where when it comes to that fourth quarter, so right, the first quarter happens, Drinkwitz is basically waiting to see what the other team does. He counterpunches in the second quarter. Third quarter comes, the other team makes the adjustments. Drinkwitz either doesn't know how or doesn't care to, if you buy into my conspiracy theory. Thank you for everybody who responded to that. I did have some people write in. But, you know, the third quarter, he doesn't really prepare for that. And then the fourth quarter, I wonder if the point is to counterpunch. But at that point, what you're running into is an offensive line that is at a talent deficiency, big talent deficiency, and is starting to basically lose control of the game. They have lost all control of the game, I should say. Yeah. And then you look at some of the playmakers are younger and or inexperienced guys. I'm thinking about Cody Schrader. This is his first year playing Division I football. Guys like Luther Burden or Mekhi Miller, who we've seen them turn to late in games, or even someone like Nate Pete. You know, he's a Division I running back, but this is the SEC. He's seen a lot of faster defenses, more athletic defenses, and just I'm sure that wears on you after a while. And so I wonder if the counterpunch isn't happening because Eli Drinkwitz has an offense full of guys that either don't have the talent or the experience to quite keep up that long into an SEC football game. I guess we should be encouraged maybe then that means that Eli Drinkwitz does know how to counter in the middle of a game that does present quite a few concerns about this being his fourth year as a head coach and not being able to write a full game script specifically going into the half. That is incredibly concerning.
It is. And you know, who knows? We can sit here and we can assume what the play calls are and how they're supposed to look and, you know, the execution and all that stuff. And, you know, maybe they're doing it, maybe they're not. You know, credit to them. The first drive against Vanderbilt ended up in a touchdown. Like, okay, that was good. Not the second one ended up in an interception. But, you know, you get the idea. Like, sometimes it's good. When you play really bad teams like Vanderbilt, sometimes your opening script works out just fine. If you play a team with, you know, equivalent talent or a little bit of motivation, like an Auburn, like a Florida, like a Georgia, less efficient, less good. So I'm not totally sure. It was an interesting pattern that I have noticed while doing these, that they just seem to have this massive shoot in second quarter and then just a slow decline. Now, part of that was by design in the Vanderbilt game. And, you know, Eli Drinkwitz, like he always does, takes full blame. He says, yeah, you know, that was on me. I did find it really funny that he apologized for Brady Cook's sack fumble in the third quarter by saying, I was being a little too aggressive. Eli, buddy, that's not something we're ever accusing you of being too aggressive, okay? Just flat out. I understand that it didn't work, and maybe calling a pass within, you know, inside your own five with that offensive line, maybe it is risky, maybe that's what you're talking about. But no, I'm good with aggressive. You can do that. It's just at this point, you know, Eli Drinkwitz is that jerk boyfriend who says, oh, yeah, I'm going to be better next time. And then, you know, he all lip service and then nothing really changes. Now, unlike that jerk boyfriend, I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that offensive line troubles, wide receiver troubles, running back troubles, quarterback troubles. Like, there's just nothing that you can do. There's no magic play that you can call to work around that sort of thing. But we also have 3 years of experience at this point with this guy, and he just tends to call more conservative games. So thought that was interesting. There were a couple other nuggets that came out from the press tour of this week so far that I felt like worth mentioning. The first one in this, I just saw this one, so bear with me here. Apparently, Eli Drinkwitz went into detail on what's going on with Chance Looper. I know we've all kind of, you all assume or think about what's happening with a player injury. And in this case, Eli said that Chance Looper's condition is a blood clot in his lung, and he woke up with that on Thursday, the day of the Louisiana Tech game. That was certainly one thing that I think we had discussed in the Rock M Slack. And this is true. Now, clots are scary stuff, especially when you are an athlete, or really just anybody, but certainly an athlete with all the blood movement and what you need. Blood clot in the lung, scary stuff. So he is on blood thinners right now. We all kind of figured he was out for the season. That is definitely an out for the season thing. I think Drinkwitz said that he was coming back in November, which is essentially the end of the season. So scary stuff for Chance. Hope he is doing well. The other thing that came out is that Drinkwitz was asked directly, I think from Dave Matter, if he would be willing to give up play calling responsibilities. And he, to the surprise of me, certainly said yes, he would be willing to do that. However, he said that he wasn't willing to do that until next season. He said that he got this team into this mess and it was his responsibility to get out of it. Now, again, I go back to the point where there's no magical play that works around a lackluster offensive line and skill position that's banged up. But it is really weird. He's like, oh, I'm totally open it, but not now. Like, what are we waiting for? Like, it seems like a really weird excuse to be like, well, it's my fault we're in here, so I'm not going to give up play calling. What do you make of that kind of statement?
Well, I mean, it's not that all that surprising, to be honest. I think the truth of the matter is Eli Drinkwitz wants to call his own plays. He wants to be his own offensive coordinator. I mean, that much is obvious. He's been doing it all 3 years. He's been at Mizzou. He did it at Appalachian State. I think if he had his druthers, he'd do it for the rest of his career, right? Especially at an SEC school. If you can pull that off, then you're going to be in demand moving forward in your career. And as we discussed in Dad Pod version one, that is something that Eli Drinkwitz is very much interested in. Now, I think that is also a bit of, he's doing a little bit of, I don't remember what the term for it is for, but he's essentially preparing for the offseason. Because here's the deal. If Mizzou ends up 5-7, doesn't make a bowl, or maybe even 4-8, if they only win one more game for the rest of the year, I don't think Drink is going to get fired. But certainly the administration is going to come to him and say changes need to be made. And the very first thing that they're going to ask him is, are you willing to let go of some responsibilities in order to become more fully the head coach as opposed to the head coach and the offensive coordinator? Because I think a lot of us, and I believe rightly so, think that he's bitten off a little bit more than he can chew. And giving up that responsibility, I think, is the most outward sign that he is taking an inward look and saying, I'm willing to change the things that I do in order to make this program more successful. That's just in terms of at the administrative level, at the program level, that's like the biggest thing that he can do. I think he's smart enough to know that, hey, that's going to be something that someone's going to ask me about in the future if things don't get turned around. And so I need to be able to say, yeah, of course I'm willing to do that. Because, I mean, as much as I don't think he wants to be at Mizzou, I also don't think he wants to get fired. No, that's very much what he doesn't want to happen. But I do think this. I do still think that, of course, Eli Drinkwitz has some level of belief that this team can maybe sneak a few wins and get to a bowl game. And if you do that, and let's say by some miracle the offense starts to turn around, then you maybe get to a point in the offseason, well, maybe the administration doesn't quite ask that of you. Maybe they don't make it a required thing that you have to give up play calling. And if you come out right away and say, of course, yeah, I'm going to turn play calling over right away. Well, that's just waving the white flag, right, on something that he doesn't want to do. Mm-hmm. So I think he is hedging his bet a little bit. I think he is saying, hey, this is his inner monologue. Let me be Eli Drinkwitz for a second. If I get to the end of this season and things haven't turned around, I'm going to have to do some things in order to keep my job. And I guess I can turn over play calling to probably to someone he knows and trusts, likely someone that is already in the staff mm-hmm. or someone who has already been on the staff and maybe has gone away that might be able to be lured back. But if I can somehow sneak a few more wins out of this team, get to a bowl game, maybe even win a bowl game, all of a sudden it's not looking so bad for me. And why would I have to give up play calling then? I just helped mm-hmm. this team do a second half turnaround. So I think he is. I think he's really kind of playing both sides of the fence there. I think it's smart, and I also think you'd have to be stupid not to say if Dave Matter asked that question, he's like, "Nope, I'm the play caller here. No ifs, ands, or buts about it." I mean, that's just dumb. So I can't say I was all that surprised. I think it's just self-preservation, sure. as it were.
Sure.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I mean, BK and I have talked about this both on and off the show before, and he has been pretty adamant previously. It's like, you know, when Missouri hired Eli Drinkwitz, they hired him to be their head coach. Yes. But they hired him because they believed that he could bring an offensive design, an offensive scheme that would be unique, that would be a difference maker in the SEC. And so they made that hire with a very obvious caveat of he's also going to be our OC. And so BK mm-hmm. is of the mind, and I don't think he's completely wrong, where if you don't want him to be the offensive coordinator anymore, you also do not want him to be your head coach. And while I understand the sentiment, I don't think that's a 100% or 0% kind of thing. You know, he, like you said, Drinkwitz is a smart guy. He also likes to make, you know, be employed and not get fired. And if he can do something simple like that, he's already given up being the quarterback coach. He did that. I think after the first year, maybe the second year. It's not unprecedented for him to give something up. Now, giving up quarterback coach is a very, very small thing to give up, especially when you are also the head coach and the OC. But, you know, maybe at this point he has realized the limitations or just the pressure of being all of that at once and understands that, yeah, you know what, maybe it is a little bit more than what I can do. But to your point, let's see if I can turn this thing around. Because there's nothing Eli Drinkwitz loves more than himself. And so he would love to have that opportunity. So, yeah, I think it makes sense. I don't know who you hire. Like you said, either someone who's previously been on staff or currently on staff. If you look at the offensive staff right now, Curtis Looper has been a coordinator before. He was a co-coordinator at TCU.
Yes.
I like those TCU offenses. Okay. He would rip it up. At the same time, There's also a gentleman who used to be on staff that is no longer on staff that is currently hanging out at SMU. His name is Casey Woods. He was my favorite of the first staff. And his pony offense is currently 25th in offensive SP+. So I don't know what he would come back for. I don't know what his contract is. I don't know how much money we have to play with for the staff. But I would assume it's either Looper or if they go out, maybe a Casey Woods they take a flyer on. But I don't know. I know you know nothing, Josh, but is there anybody that you would like to see call plays for Mizzou?
Either one of those two, honestly. I mean, I could see Bush Hamden maybe getting Hamdan, as I like to call him. I like to because here's the thing. You're right. Eli Drinkwitz is not above giving away some responsibilities, but he's also not going to give them away just to some random guy that he doesn't know that he doesn't trust. He is a little more insular in that way. And here's the thing. Eli Drinkwitz, we have a lot of criticisms about him, sure, but he does a lot of things that you want a head coach to do. He does them very well. He is a really good recruiter, at least when it comes to stars and rankings. He knows how to drum up excitement about that. Great marketer. Really, I feel like he's brought an overall sense of exciting marketing know-how to Mizzou sports in general. I mean, look at all the programs that are now doing bat signals and all kind of stuff like that. He just seems to be really good at that. He can identify coaches who can develop talent. I really like some of the work that some of the coaches are doing. It's just, you know, the coaching part that needs a little work. And you wonder if maybe he was willing to give up some of those in-game responsibilities that he would be able to improve himself in that way. I think on some level we get into this really insular state where we think, oh, this coach is good and this coach is bad. I would posit that most people who are coaching football at the Division I level are good football coaches, at least to a degree. It's just a matter of letting your own hubris and letting your own faults that you can't see get in the way. And a lot of guys let their own faults get in the way and they can never become better. And, you know, I'd like to think that Drinkwitz can get better and that he can win a few more games this year and maybe have a breakout next year. And, but we'll see. I don't know. I would really like if he turned over those responsibilities. And I know that if he does, he's going to do it to someone that he knows. So Curtis Looper, I think, would be a fine choice. I think Casey Woods would really be a good get if they can go out and bring him back. Certainly that would be, there would be some good optics there. You're bringing in a guy that not turned around, but basically went to an offense and performed really well and you were able to bring him back. So yeah, we'll see. I would say the likelihood of that happening is probably pretty high at this point. So,
you know, the interesting thing about college football coaches is that the type of coach always kind of goes in cycles. You know, in earlier years, you know, think post-war 1950s, it was football coaches, man, football coaches, like the guys who play, the guys who know the game, you know, you're gonna fall down, you're gonna bleed, I'm gonna chop off your arm, we're gonna put it back on with some dirt, let's go, baby. Those kind of guys, that's what a lot of football players grew up with, and for a long time, that was the kind of guy that you wanted. This sport has become more segmented, more departmentalized. And so that type of coach, which I would argue Barry Odom was very much that kind of coach, that, you know, in the trenches with you, the players coach, like those sorts of coaches are rarer now than they used to be. And they don't really connect as well on the college level as they used to. Now, typically players love that type of coach, but like, it doesn't work as well. Then you got like scheme guys. And I'm thinking like a Josh Heupel, a scheme guy, a Gus Malzahn is a scheme guy. And they're the ones that you hire and they come in. I say, we're going to install this system. It's going to be something completely different that you've never seen before. It's going to be, you know, it's going to either bridge the gap of the talent gap that this team currently has with the rest of the conference, or it's going to take you so much further off than your competition can ever think of. And it's going to be such a schematic advantage that no one's going to be able to keep up with us. Like Ryan Day at Ohio State, like those types of guys. That's tough because then it's kind of like an Eli Drinkwitz where it's like, well, we're running my stuff, right? We're running my book, so I need to be involved. Those guys work, you know. Think of like a Jamie Chadwell at Coastal Carolina. It's funky, it's different, but you are relying on that scheme staying ahead of the curve for multiple years in a sport where the curve gets flattened very, very quickly when defensive coordinators get 2 years of film and go, oh, I got it. So that's a tough one too. Then you get the CEO kind of coach, and that's going to be more like a Mac Brown. That's what Nick Saban is now. That's certainly what Kirby Smart has become, where they might have had a specialty. They might have had something that set them apart from their peers to get hired in the first place, but their skill is organizing the booster corps, reorganizing the athletic department, being that pitch man, being that spokesperson, being a politician and a football coach, right? You can raise money one day, kiss the baby the next, and then beat the ass of your opponent the next day. Like that kind of person. And they're a little bit more hands-off, but their organizational like abilities, the ability to raise money to get the facilities that they want, the stuff that they need, that is the skill. And then you make smart hires, smart assistant hires that do all the stuff that you want to do in your vision, that you don't have to do because you got other stuff that you got being taken care of. So I think CEO coaches right now are kind of the trend. You know, if you think about like the rah-rah goofy coaches like PJ Fleck, that was a very short curve where a lot of people like, you know, dancing in the locker room and stuff like that. That's not really sticking either, but that's good for an underdog. I think a CEO coach is more along the lines of what you're looking for. So if I'm making a coach hire and someone says, well, you know, we're going to run my system and, you know, I'm going to be the coordinator, for me, that's less appealing to me than it used to be in years prior, because I just want someone who knows what you need to succeed and can make smart hires to get that done. If you have to do it yourself, then you're overtaxed and you're not paying as much attention to other stuff that you need. So I would love to see a coordinator, an offensive coordinator being brought on or just promoted from within. But it's just, you know, this sport is continually evolving. And right now, a head coach who is kind of a little bit of everything is just, it just doesn't work like it used to.
Can I posit that Eli Drinkwitz is a CEO guy who thinks he's a scheme guy?
Oh my God. Yes. Yes.
When you were saying that, when you were listing out the different types of guys, and you know a lot more about college football than I do, and I've never thought about coaches in that way, but like, all the things that a CEO does, that's what Eli Drinkwitz does well. He gets the boosters engaged. He gets the fan base engaged. He brings in good assistants who do the things that he wants them to do. He knows how to market the program and himself in just such a way to where there is, like, especially at a place like Missouri, I think he's done really well. He's like elevated Missouri's profile enough to where they're annoying other teams, even when they're not doing super well. Because Missouri hasn't been great under him, but they do get under other teams' skins. Like, you just need to go on Twitter to learn that. Mm-hmm. And he has his own like profile. Like, he is a character in his own right, and he does all that stuff well. But he thinks he's like a Ryan Day, where he's like, I'm a mastermind offensive. When if he would honestly just focus on bringing in a real offensive mastermind at offensive coordinator, maybe with the way that he wants his team to play, sure. But I think he would have a lot more success in that way. It's just a matter of is he going to learn that? And if he does, is it going to be too late for it to be at Missouri? So,
yeah. I mean, he's got at least another year to figure it out. We'll see what he does. And of course, the rest of this year too. Like, I know we're kind of writing it off, you know, but there's still 5 games to go. So, I don't know. We will see.
Is that a good transition point to the Mayor's Cup?
I mean, I can't think of a better one. We are headed to Columbia East this week. I don't know. Josh, do you think South Carolina is Missouri's true SEC rival?
Well, man, I don't know. That's a question that I feel like I ask every year during pregame and whenever we play South Carolina, and I didn't do it this year. I guess some of the biggest games we've had in our SEC history have been against South Carolina. I think none bigger than the just horrific 2013 game. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're a peer program. They're right about on the same level of success as we are. Of course, they don't have the division titles in the last X amount of years, but they've been generally about the same. I don't personally feel a ton of antipathy toward South Carolina. No, I mean, I certainly hate a school like Tennessee more than I do South Carolina, but I suppose if you were choosing a team, if you think about the way that Sam and Matt, or the Sam and the Mats, always talk about basketball, about like basically fighting your way up from the middle, trying to get into that upper middle. South Carolina is the team that Missouri stacks up against the cleanest. So I guess rivalry in that sense, but certainly not, at least for me, not rivalry in the sense that I hate them and I want to see them lose every game. And I want to see them lose against, I mean, I do want to see them lose against Missouri, but.
Man, it's so weird because like Tennessee, I do not like Tennessee because I don't like their fans. And by their fans, I mean like the most online fans. I think that's what most people think. They just, they're so annoying. But like from a game perspective, like Missouri-Tennessee football series is just like Rochambeau. They just take turns like walloping each other in the nuts. And it's like 53-17 a couple of years. And then it turns around and it's like 48-2. Like there's just, there's not a lot of close games there except for the 2012 one, which was a classic. But like, either one is just whipping on the other or vice versa. South Carolina, they're always close games. Well, they're usually close games. And like you said, they are kind of in that middle pack and you're trying to fight out of it. And it's like, oh, these guys again, like serious. And so I think I don't mind South Carolina fans, but I want to beat their team. I don't like Tennessee fans. I don't mind their team, but like, I always want them to lose because their fans suck. So I don't, it's weird. And I don't think that's unique to Missouri. I think most people are not fans of Tennessee in general. But yeah, we'll talk about Tennessee more when we get there. South Carolina is this week. Josh, just to make sure you are up to date on everything, Eli Drinkwitz is 2-10 in true road games. He is 2-8 in conference road games. And he is 0-4 in conference road games against ranked opponents. So South Carolina is ranked. They are a conference game. They are on the road. So let me do my math here. Yeah, this is going to be a loss, just flat out. How does that make you feel?
Bad. I don't like when Missouri loses. Yeah, I don't like when Missouri loses football games. My ideal state of how a Missouri football game would turn out. I got to be honest. I don't know if I'm going out on a limb there, but. Don't particularly care for it.
So I did, you have all these things going against you. And then you look at South Carolina a little bit deeper. And last year, South Carolina went 7-5. And it was a huge surprise, right? Because it was Shane Beamer's first year. South Carolina was terrible and a Will Muschamp towards the end. And I was like, all right, well, you know, Shane Beamer's a CEO coach. He's going to have to take some time to build it. And then they went 7-5. But when you look at how they did it, they went 5-1 against teams that were ranked 55th or worse in SP Plus, and then they went 2-4 against teams that were 54th or better. So I was like, all right, well, you were slightly better than medium to bad teams, and you mostly lost to good teams. Okay, well, you just got lucky that you had mostly bad teams on your schedule. Cool. Well, this year, they are 2-0 against opponents ranked 55th or worse, and they are 2-2 against opponents ranked 54th or better. We're almost at the exact same spot. If you have an athletic advantage or a talent advantage or some schematic advantage over them, you're cooked. If you don't, they're going to win. So, you know, I will point out that they did just beat Texas A&M. Now, Josh, I don't know if you know this, but Texas A&M, a lot of five stars, supposed to be pretty good.
Missouri, right? But with better talent.
Missouri with five stars. You got it. Do you know how South Carolina beat Texas A&M? Did you look at the box score or watch that game at all?
I can't say that I did.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you. Here's how South Carolina did it. They took the opening kickoff for a touchdown. They then proceeded to pick off A&M's backup quarterback for a pick for an interception that was returned to the one that they then got a touchdown on, forced a punt, and then kicked a field goal. 12 minutes into the game, it was 17-0, and they just coasted.
I did catch that because my sister-in-law is an A&M grad and my wife was on the phone with her. And I remember I was putting the boys to bed and I heard my wife go, "Oh no." And I went outside and I said, "Oh, this game got out of hand really quickly." And cause I think my sister-in-law was upset, but yeah, I mean, South Carolina, I was looking at their record because obviously they're ranked now, and I was looking at their schedule, and it is kind of what you said. I mean, they got absolutely waxed by Georgia, and they lost by two scores to Arkansas, which, you know, Arkansas is not great. I think even I'm a little surprised at how disappointing they've been this year. They have one really good win, which is at Kentucky. That's a good win. I can't really take that away from them. And then they squeaked one out against Jimbo Fisher's A&M, which, wow, talk about a disaster. But then their other wins are over Charlotte and South Carolina State and Georgia State. I mean, credit to Shane Beamer. They're 5-2. They are more likely than not going to a bowl. They've got Vanderbilt next week. But I think there is a pretty real possibility that they're just going to end this year 500. I don't know that I totally believe that South Carolina is a top 25 team.
So South Carolina in 2022 reminds me a lot of Missouri in 2020. Now their defense is a little bit better, but basically their offense is very, very opportunistic. They're not super great at throwing the ball. Spencer Rattler hardly ever surpasses 200 yards passing in a game. They like to run with Marshawn Lloyd, who's very good, former five-star. If they can't get it on the ground, you know, in third down situations, then they ask Spencer Rattler to throw, and they're actually pretty good in passing down situations and third down situations. But sometimes they're not. And so they just kind of run the ball. They let their defense put them in good positions, and then they have elite special teams. And boy, that is the Drinkwitz recipe for the past 3 years, and it was the one that worked in 2020. So it's kind of man in the mirror opportunity here, a Spider-Man pointed at Spider-Man. Like, this is the same type of team. And so, you know, we've complained about the play calling and the lack of talent on offense. And it's like, well, you got to do something different. You got to throw the ball. And then I'm going to turn around and say, no, against South Carolina, you need to run the ball and then hold on and hope you don't have any turnovers and finish your drives. Because that's literally how it's going to work. Their passing defense is excellent. Their running defense is awful because they like to just keep everything in front of them. We'll give you 4 yards, but you got to do that 12 times, and somewhere down the line, you're going to screw up. And I tell you, Missouri is really good at screwing up, so that's a recipe that's going to win. But if you can hold on to the ball, you can move it down the field, and as long as your Missouri special teams don't go boom, you're going to be hanging in there in the fourth quarter, either down one score or up one score, and just hope that the other team screws it up. And it's just, each team is just going to be playing to hope the other one messes it up. And I don't think it's going to be a very good-looking game. It's probably going to be a stressful game like they've all been, but it's going to play out exactly like every other game is played, and I don't know how it's going to end up, but this is going to be a very, very Missouri in 2022 game.
Yeah, I don't think I'm more confident in anything than the fact that Missouri will be within striking distance as this game is in its dying breaths. Missouri's defense has proven over and over again that it will give them chances to win games against teams that are much, much better than South Carolina. And, you know, the fact that they're going to probably have to take the ball out of Brady Cook's hands. Oh God, the thought of run blocking with this Tiger team is so off. It's so horrifying. Truly spooky season.
Yeah,
I guess this we talked about last on Sunday. I guess this opens up opportunities. Maybe if you can get the ball in Luther Burden's hands a few more times in the run game, only guy in the country with multiple rushing, multiple receiving, and a punt return touchdown. So got some opportunities to get some unique looks for him. Cody Schrader and Nate Pete. I think it's Nate Pete's turn to have a good week this week. So it that's is, good. Yep. I mean, he's a little more explosive. Yeah, I mean, the recipe for an upset is there. And like I said, I don't really believe that South Carolina is any sort of monster that Missouri's going to have any, like it's going to be impossible to conquer them. It's really, again, just a matter of what we said on Sunday. Can Missouri's defense hold all four quarters in order to give their offense enough times to get their offense enough opportunities to break through and, you know, score more points, which I don't see that. I think what I wrote in pregame and when I put my answers in this week was just, I'm holding my stock answer of I'll believe it when I see it. So,
Yeah, me too. We'll see what happens. That's 3 o'clock on Saturday. Another 3 o'clock kickoff. That's an odd one. Just as a reminder, Eli Drinkwitz is undefeated in games that kick off at 3 o'clock Central. So there's a streak that's on the line. That'll be fun. We did have some roster movements late this afternoon. I don't know if you saw this, Josh, but LJ Hewitt, cornerback, is going to hit the transfer portal. He's going to stay on campus. He's going to finish the season. But once the season is done, he is going to portal out of here and somewhere else. What do you think of this news?
Who? I'm sorry?
LJ Hewitt.
Isn't he like a real estate agent in St. Louis or something? Does he play football?
Well, he might be a real estate agent soon. I don't know. Okay. Well, so Josh is knows nothing about football, and we all know that. But LJ Hewitt, or Les Hewitt, he was an addition in May. He was a JUCO transfer from Holmes County, and he was brought on to be a super tall corner. And then he saw three snaps against Louisiana Tech and got himself suspended, along with DJ Jackson and Davion Sistrunk. Now, there's been no police report, so I can only assume it's some version of breaking the rules of the team. You can fill in the gap on what you think that is going to be, but when you transfer into a place, Josh, as a JUCO, and you're told that you're going to play, and then you get yourself in a situation where you don't play, seems pretty obvious that you're not going to be sticking around all that long, and voila, he is gone. So I'm sorry that you never knew who he was, Josh, but you're never going to have to. Does that make you feel happy?
I mean, I really have no feelings one way or the other, I have to say. I don't know who this man is. Sorry to this man, to quote Kiki Palmer. I best of luck, Mr. Hewitt. Mm-hmm. I hope you find somewhere that you're going to play, and I guess happy trails. I get that we're doing a bit a little bit here, but I do, when I did read the news today that he was transferring, my first reaction really was like, who? It's like, who's this guy? I mean, it's roster movement. Mm-hmm. We talked about it. Who is he going to supplant on the roster?
Yeah.
At this point, right? I mean, Missouri's secondary, if we're talking about strengths of the team, that's the strength of the team. So he wasn't going to start playing over anybody else. And I think we've even got more guys on the two deep and coming up soon that are going to make it difficult for him to see playing time. So, yeah, I guess good luck to him. But,
Yeah, writing's on the wall. It happens. This is college football. Another college thing that happened, we'll get out after this one, and this is more of an NCAA thing. Remember those guys that try to enforce laws and stuff, which, teehee, you all are silly. You'll know about this one, Josh, because this is more up your purview. But there's a couple changes for the NIL rules, or I guess they're interim rules now, that the NCAA decided to release today. I want to make sure I get this right. So schools can't, quote, they can't engage in negotiations on behalf of an NIL entity or a student athlete to secure specific NIL opportunities. So schools, coaches, administration can't provide free services like graphic designers, tax prep, or, you know, contract review, any of that stuff. They can't provide free services to student athletes unless those services are available to the general student body. Now, it's going to be the same with equipment like cameras, graphics, softwares, or computers. And of course, according to the new NIL policy, schools can request donors to provide funds to collectives and other NIL entities, provided the schools do not request that those funds be directed to a specific sport or a student athlete. A lot of words there, basically saying schools can't assist. How do you feel about this, Josh?
Well, first of all, it's really just the bit of a lifetime that the NCAA continues to, pretend like that these rules are going to stop anybody from doing any of this stuff. Good on them for keeping it going. I gotta say, when I first read the whole thing about schools not being able to assist and stuff like, you know, tax help and graphic design and stuff like that, I was kind of thinking about it. I was like, well, that's weird. Like, I think, was it Ryan Nanny or was it Jason Kirk from Fullcast that tweeted something about doing like accounting, like hype videos for accounting majors? Absolutely. I thought that was a good joke. Good job, Ryan. But when I started thinking about it, I thought, like, you know, okay, so how do you define that? Because if you think, you know, well, you can't provide graphic design help or equipment to athletes if it's not available to the general public. And when I think about it, I'm like, well, a lot of that equipment is just coming from the J school. Mm-hmm. And like, as a J school student, I had access to all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So I does that like make it okay? I would assume it does. I think it's just, part of me almost wonders if it's just really, it's just a lot of words to make it seem like the NCAA is getting a better handle on this, which I can't say that I think they do. It's a little confusing because it certainly does seem like there probably have been some schools that have specialty graphic design departments, maybe have specialized equipment or time or labor being dedicated to that kind of stuff, which now I guess you are going to have to lend it to the general public. So maybe accounting hype videos are not out of the question. Although I would certainly say that at Mizzou, maybe the nursing school deserves some of those hype videos.
Heck yeah.
I don't know, man. You're, to quote John C. Reilly, yours is the house of learned doctors, or I guess the house of learned lawyers.
Yeah.
So what do you think? What's the legal take on this?
I mean, the legal take right now is language, of course, because we see these in a series of tweets. We don't see what the actual content of the words are, other than the select quotes here and there. Definitions, language is always going to be how you break this down. But even outside of that, my main takeaway is, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
Like, now that, unless you're trying to get rid of your coach, most schools just shut up and say, all right, prove it. So outside of Kansas and Tennessee, everyone's just like, nah, prove it. And they don't do anything. After, Missouri was really the last one that self-reported and played along. And they got kicked in the wiener for it. And I think everyone else went, no, not anymore. So I don't know how they're going to enforce this. Because right now schools are doing this. They're doing it right now. And so now you're just going to roll out and say, well, now you can't anymore. You can't do that. Okay. How are you going to enforce that?
It's going to be so easy for schools to just find those loopholes, right? Like I just found one, right? Like 2 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And I'm me. Right. Like if you're Mizzou and you're Eli Drinkwitz and you're like, well, shoot, now we have to make sure that everybody else has access to this equipment and this technology and stuff. Just be like, yeah, you can get it if you fill out these three forms and you consult someone and then you have to sit through a waiting, you're just gonna bury it in paperwork. And what's the NCAA going to do about it? And then even if you do break a rule, it really is at Mizzou, no institution in the country should there be more clear of direction that if the NCAA comes knocking, you say, here's the bird, get off my porch, than the University of Missouri Columbia.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah. I don't know. I'm really curious what the penalties are going to be. Number two, how they're going to enforce it. Number three, what it exactly it says. Cause the NCAA are fools, fools on a mountaintop, but they've been there for a while because they're not dumb. So that they must have something about the loophole that you found, or I don't know. But at the same time, it's such an antiquated system that no one's really paying attention anymore. And they had 120 years to figure this out, and they just slapped something together in a year and a half, and it's still not any good. So I'm not really super worried about it. I don't think anyone else is either. They're going to try to get somebody, and the first case that they bust, everyone's just going to stop and look at it. And then see how it goes and then just keep doing exactly what they've always been doing or adjust around the findings that come out from it. So it's silly.
It feels like it's just the latest in a long line of attempts in order for the NCAA to say, look, our student athletes are just like every other student because all these students have access to the same thing. And it's just like, yeah, all right. You've been singing this same song and dance for Lord knows how long. None of us buy it. Just shut up and go away. Let us have our thing. So
yeah, I'm just a bunch of nothing. I can't wait to see what comes out of it. Well, who the first school that's going to get popped is going to do, what that's going to look like, the first player that gets dinged for this sort of thing. I don't know, But I can tell you right now, they're not going to stop. They're certainly not going to stop. So it's just going to be business as usual until we get that first case. And that's really going to make the big difference. So
I really hope it involves tax help. Like God, it's some, so. Like they, like someone, it's like a really lengthy drawn out process of like a star quarterback had help on his taxes from his mega NIL deal. And it's that's just the type of stupid news story that the NCAA deserves, honestly.
Absolutely.
And I hope that quarterback keeps playing afterwards. The school is just like, no, prove it. And then he just keeps playing.
Yeah. Well, this is a good show. We went pretty decent in the length here. And you got not only a revisit of a terrible Vanderbilt game and a preview of what's probably going to be a terrible South Carolina game, we also got to talk taxes and loopholes in the NCAA. Can you ask for anything more, Josh? I would argue no.
No, I mean, I feel like in keeping with the dad pod spirit, talking about taxes and loopholes is a thing that a lot of dads like to get into, yeah. For sure.
God, I should buy a boat. I should really buy a boat.
Oh, man.
We'll talk about that later. But for now, that is going to be the show for today. As always, we appreciate the downloads and the subscriptions. You can leave a comment or you can rate us. We love all types of feedback from you all. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Nate G. Edwards. He is at Josh Magica. And of course, you can follow the Rockin' Flagship at Rockin' Nation. We appreciate you tuning in this time. We'll try to do better next time. And until then, M-I-Z.
Z-O-U.